This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Bruce Mills is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College. He is also the author of An Archaeology of Yearning, which is a memoir about himself and his family. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Gordon.
Let's start with that title, An Archaeology of Yearning. What does that mean?
It means that my experience and the experience I wanted to relate in the memoir was not simply telling of one event. For instance, an experience I may have had with my son. It was about putting that situation or that experience in the context that had many layers and should be understood across a certain amount of time. So once I came to that title, An Archaeology of Yearning, which is the ending chapter, the title of the ending chapter, and it had been published in another version, I understood, yes, this is what the book is about. It's about having some things, artifacts that I find, memories that I have, and I want to relate them as specifically, as concretely, as emotionally charged as they are and have been, and then to place them in a context.
And the stories, in many cases, are about your son, Jacob.
Yes.
Who is autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, as you go and you start, as you say, these are the stories that you decided to include in the book, is there also a bit of an editing process there that you say, well, there's certain stories that I think tell this better, even if maybe there's another story that on its own is more interesting?
Yes. It's an interesting thing about the writing process. I teach short fiction at Kalamazoo College, and I constantly remind myself and my students, a writer, an artist, select some things from among many. And so there are many memories that I could select from. And the question becomes what becomes, in a sense, the parable, the thing that captures the larger truth. Sometimes one example of that would be, I suppose, I knew I wanted to talk about the experience my wife and I had sleeping with my son. It's in the chapter Sleeping with Jacob. And so I knew I was going to, that was not difficult. That was a major part of our life, and I wanted to do that. As I was writing that and thinking about that, however, there's something that came forward that I hadn't anticipated, and that was when I was trying to lay down, sleep with my son, and he was awake, and he'd be awake sometimes till 4 or 5 in the morning, and I'd begin telling myself these stories just to kind of make sense of my experience, thinking ahead to the next day. And there'd be a time when it came to something that was I wanted to remember. And I had this sudden memory of, oh, I used to take pieces of paper or anything that I could grab and toss in the middle of the floor. So hopefully the next day I go, oh, yeah, I toss that there because this is what I had begun to tell. This is like a memory stone. And the reason I'm relating that is that moment then connected up with what I tell in that chapter is like Hansel and Gretel. How do you find your way home? and Hansel and Gretel is a story about abandonment. It is a story about being lost. So the selection process was highly edited, and it went through a number of different drafts. And the book went through a number of different drafts.
In part, were you trying to make sure that you told not just the story of Jacob, but the story of your daughter, Sarah, and what she went through?
Yes. That was an important part of the book, and it is an important part of the book for me. And one of the reasons it's important, because in telling the story of our family, my daughter, who was 21 months older than my son, played an important role and had demands placed on her that are not necessarily typical of a sibling. It doesn't mean you have to have a brother or sister with autism to experience with my daughter experience, being more like a care provider at times than a sibling.
Almost a third parent.
Yeah, almost a third parent at times. But that is a part of the story of our family, and I wanted to make sure that was in the book. It's interesting by then selecting, this process of selecting and editing and what I chose, that was a little bit different because I sat down with my daughter. We went out to Crow's Nest here in Kalamazoo, and I said, what do you remember? Tell me your memories. And so I had a list of things that she had given me that I honored a little more. I didn't edit those out as much in terms of, because those are things that seemed important to be told.
And in part, if that's her memory, then it's part of the story as well. Even if perhaps you remembered a little differently, or you remember other things, her memories are an important part of this.
Yes, and I tried to honor how she remembered it. In the end, though, I'm the storyteller, and that's the difficult thing, but the important thing a memoirist has to remember. I'm telling the story. My daughter didn't go back and edit any of the sections. My wife didn't. Jacobs didn't. So that is an important... The story is my take on it all, how I understood it in the language I was careful in managing to tell the story.
The format here is also interesting in that it doesn't necessarily go in chronological order. We kind of move around at different points in your life, both in time and place. We don't follow you necessarily from spring of 1998 to summer of 1998. We might go from spring of 1998 to summer of 2004.
That's right. And I had started to write the chronological book. I had written 70 to 80 pages of that book, 2000, 2001, sometime around those years. And it wasn't working. And part of the reason it wasn't working, I felt it didn't seem to capture the emotional tenor of the experience, because when we remember and we tell stories, it's not necessarily chronological. That's one way in which stories get told. But for this story, and that's why the archaeological metaphor was so important, it became more critical. What's the thing that's coming to the surface, and how can I begin to generate a unity or coherence around those things? So in my book, there's four sections, three parts of each section, and the beginning of each section includes a very, very brief piece. And in a sense, that's the thing that surfaces. It's a particular memory, but it's meant to create an emotional landscape that I explore. And then it's not chronological. It's more emotional, I guess, spiritual. I like to think of it as a way of entering a story on various stories that honors how we move across the past and the present and into the future.
Well, let's have you read a passage from your book now. This is from when you found out that Jacob had actually been diagnosed as autistic.
Okay. In the winter prior to his third birthday, Mary and I had Jacob assessed by a speech therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, and an occupational therapist at Croydon. I remember watching him go through the physical tests and table play with a sense of pride. As Mary joined the psychologist behind the one-way mirror in an adjoining room, I sat just off his shoulder, encouraging him, following him from toy to toy. I had to fight the urge to offer a running narrative of my son's seemingly special behaviors. Jacob likes to arrange magnetic letters like movie credits. He has great balance. He lines up toys for hours. After the formal testing, as we all got ready to leave, Jacob noticed a mirror standing against the wall. He was fascinated with his image in it. He danced and walked back and forth in front of the tall length of glass. The act seemed so childlike that I enjoyed the play of it until I noticed the two observers exchange glances. 2 weeks later, the psychologist on the assessment team met with us at our home. She indicated that Jacob had been diagnosed as autistic. Calmly and gently, she reviewed the report, underscoring why his behaviors indicated autism. She especially noted the language deficits, the tendency to lose words. She recommended some readings, suggesting that when we were ready, we could review materials that discussed the long-term possibilities. She said that autism was not curable. It was a lifelong condition. She noted that because Jacob appeared to be so high-functioning, he might especially benefit from early and intensive educational interventions to build vocabulary and learn social skills. When she left, Mary and I sat at the table, glancing at the materials before us. We did not want to say goodbye to the Jacob we had imagined forward in time, the brother who would accompany his sister to the same schools, who would converse with her about teachers they might have shared. In our mind's eye, we caught glimpses of this unimagined child when he grew into awkward manhood, and then we wept for him and for ourselves. We had no story for this moment and this place.
There's a few times in this book you make a reference to sort of this idea that you had of your son while your wife was pregnant, and then maybe shortly after he was born, and that it was different from where we are now? And a lot of parents probably go through that in some way, but was this more of a stark brick wall, I guess, where you just kind of ran into it and realized at a relatively early age that Jacob was going to be a different person than perhaps you had envisioned him being before he was born?
Yeah, I think this is a common element of this kind of story, and that is when I was talking about how I teach short stories, I also tell students that we live in story. We're in the present, but our memories are constructed as story. It's a narrative out of our past, and we haven't lived the future. It's something we're imagining and we're giving shape to in story. So it's a natural thing when you have a child, I think, to begin to imagine, and it's important to imagine having a child. And so there's particular concrete ways, sensory ways, building from our own memories. I was in a family of seven. I had two younger brothers. All those things that help build a story. Well, inevitably, something doesn't happen in the way you imagine. And so there is something more dramatic with autism, because some of the behaviors you often see that I saw when Jacob was younger and that we saw when Jacob was younger were more dramatically kind of withdrawal, lining up toys, like I describe here, losing language. And so it feels like it's not simply there's a new story. You wonder if there's a story where you can have connection. And so that is a stark new set of experiences to try to find a way to, and I keep using the idea of storytelling, to try to find a way to narrate, to come to terms with.
But you are kind of by trade a storyteller, someone who writes. And so when you have a son who is, as you say, dropping words, and that's one of the signs here, is that what makes that connection even a little more difficult to attain, that your world is words and his world is something else?
I had to learn that words aren't the only way you communicate. And you're right. I had lived in words. I had wanted to be around story since the time I was. I'm one of the people who knew what he wanted to do very young. And so that was one of the places I had to change. Lots of people already know that you don't need words. And I had to learn that. So what does it mean to speak through behaviors? Well, how was my son acting? He'd used to do this most endearing thing. When he was losing language, he'd take us and he'd use his hands to take us around the house. And he'd have a way of communicating differently depending upon the way in which he'd grab our hand. Sometimes it'd be urgent. Sometimes he'd lift his hand into our palm in a kind of gentle way. And how could I not help but understand that as a different there's a vocabulary of the hands. And so initially that was one of the ways in which we're moving in the space of Jacob's world without words. It has its own beauty to it. It also puts a whole new set of demands, and you have to be willing to give up a lot.
All right, let's hear from a few pages later in the book. You were kind of describing the times when you might have to get out of the house and take a walk, and maybe this is telling us a little bit of what you felt in the day-to-day with Jacob.
Yeah, and what I'm going to read, too, also captures the archaeological component of the way in which I want to tell the story. Briefly, I discovered that there is this book written about a boy who was called the Wild Child, who was discovered abandoned in the forest, a forest in France in the late 18th century. And the description by the doctor there, Dr. Tard, leads us to believe that the boy had autism. And so one of the ways in which I was digging into my story was to layer it in with the story of Dr. Tard and Victor. At night, when the repetitions of Jacob's world overwhelm me, I leave the house and walk the streets of my neighborhood. Where we live, the road serves as a broad walkway. The dead-end street and infrequent traffic make for a safe passage beneath the canopy of trees. I try to listen to the way the breeze sounds when it spools through the limbs and leaves, the way the cottonwood translates wind into the sound of small waves curling along a rocky lakeshore. I want movement and space, the touch of wind on my face. On these nights, I find myself replaying events that led me outside. The frustration of my son's persistent request to buy an item on eBay, his urgent hands holding a printed page with the image and cost of some video, or his 100th drawing of Prince Charming kissing Cinderella. I cut and paste as I walk, letting the memories flicker against the dark like a neighbor's television flashing through the picture windows. I am remembering and imagining now, projecting one thing and then another. I am thinking of Victor when the rain calls him outside to sit and sway at the edge of a pond. I am hearing Dr. Tard's voice. It is mine, reading aloud. In my own reverie, I too hear Victor's voice. It is my son's on a restless night. I linger like a tard near the threshold, listening for Jacob's murmurs to lapse into the comfort of sleep. My mind records the intermingling gestures and babble. I am waiting for something to reveal itself. I want to reveal so much. And then I turn the corner and descend Dartmouth Street, having circled the neighborhood on my way back home. I pause a moment before I enter the house, looking through the small window of the front door to see Jacob catch the light of the television as he draws on the floor. In my arms, I feel a yearning, the desire to call his name and pull him gently to my chest. When I enter, I sort the finished sketches among the scattered sheets of paper before helping him brush his teeth and wash his face for bed. In his bedroom, I listen as he asks the same question over and over and smiles with satisfaction at the answer that rarely changes, the unvarying script that threatens to diminish a patient tenderness into doubt and despair. Before I go back downstairs, I let the darkness remind me of sleepless nights, the times when I had less of the past to remember and fewer stories to imagine alongside my own. And then I close my eyes and recall all the gentleness that has been and all the moving images that can still be.
Now, you mentioned cut and paste is in there, which again kind of matches the format of the book. I also, the image that came to my mind at that point was the ribbon that you see for autism awareness, which is sort of the patches with kind of puzzle pieces of different colors. Did you consider that at all, that maybe this was symbolic of that in some way?
No, actually, I tried to resist that. but I understand what you're saying. There's ways in which a story is about putting pieces of the puzzle together. The reason I say I resist it in some way, that I like to think of putting the idea of a puzzle as an emblem for someone on the autism spectrum, is not the kind of metaphor I would choose myself. It fixes the person who is not neurotypical as someone that almost has fragments to be pieced together. So it makes sense because, in fact, in some ways, that's the story I'm telling. But I guess we all have our own favorite metaphors and others that we resist.
Let's hear one more passage from the book, and this is your daughter, Sarah, moving to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
In August of 2008, we moved Sarah from home to Ann Arbor to start her first year at the University of Michigan. Atop the van, we stacked pre-cut lumber for two bed lofts. Behind the middle seat, we squeezed an apartment-sized refrigerator, computer printer, school supplies, detergent and softener for a term, and enough clothes to ride out the fashion demands of first classes and parties. The logistics of the day also involved packing for Jacob, sufficient drawing supplies, a DVD player, a stack of DVDs, a Walkman and tapes, and of course, two bags stuffed with old drawings, notebooks of Xeroxes, books, and favorite magazines. In other words, it was a normal trip for Jacob. It was an extraordinary time for Sarah, a threshold moment for her and for all of us. In the months before Sarah's move-in day, Mary and I talked about whether we both could go. The first half of the year had been especially difficult for Jacob. His 16-year-old frustrations had led to more frequent moments of aggression. In fact, we had met with a crisis team through the local district, developed a list of ready supports, including a first responder number at the crisis center, even learned techniques to deflect his physical lunges. We had talked about how to give him more freedom, to honor his desire for independence without taking away the scaffolding of necessary schedules and verbal directions. In these early years of adolescence, we understood that our listening to Jacob, as always, involved taking into account his behaviors as much as his words. And of course, we also knew that he had begun processing the fact that Sarah soon would be gone. No more soccer trips, less frequent times for eating out with Sarah, and fewer laughing alerts or duets. We're a duo, a duo. One of Jacob's and Sarah's favorite songs from An American Tale would not enter the chaotic evenings of two showers and pre-sleep movie watching.
How difficult was that moment on Jacob? And was it also difficult on Sarah? This moment, I mean, of moving away, leaving the nest is a big moment in any young person's life.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you asked. How was it for Jacob? I think I'm telling the story from my point of view, but I hope what comes through is that Jacob is negotiating all of this too. And the world's not built for him. It's built more largely for me. So it was difficult to process the way that he's beginning to understand his sister is leaving. For Sarah, it's exciting, of course. But when you move away, and this is part of a sibling story, I guess you might say, is that you don't have the same access to phone calls or to emails. So the communication potentially ends. Being around Jacob is how he communicates, the gestures, the funny laughter. And so that, Sarah, of course, had a whole new world she was entering and she was going to commit to, but calling home wasn't the same thing. And it was hard. So yeah, part of the learning for her was, and for all of us, is how to maintain connection over distance.
So continuing with that idea of archaeology, part of archaeology is that you find a piece here and a piece there and you bring them together.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you think you did with this book, is find a story here, a story there, something that happened in 2008, something that happened earlier, and as you bring them together, they more or less form one story?
Yes, and if the book title and Archaeology of Yearning, it's the yearning now that I think is helping to see what the stories themselves and why I was selecting them. Yearning has a special resonance to me because it's about something that you deeply desire and you're reaching toward. There's a movement forward in that. And so there were multiple yearnings I was describing in the things I was selected. They were my own, and that they come forward. But what I try to get to in the last chapter, my son also had his yearnings. He's communicating in his own way across this cognitive difference. And his desire to communicate was powerful. And so if there's this archaeological dig, I think one thing I discover at the end is that we meet in the yearning. That it didn't have to be the way in which I express my yearning, the way I narrate it. It could be in another way. It could be through my son's art and how I begin to understand that. But that I think that writing that helped me see more dramatically, more deeply. In a sense, I guess here's the thing. We're always separated from somebody else. I'm here. I don't know you. I don't know your history. And even if I was in the same family with you, there'd be things we didn't jointly experience. So we're all compelled to connect across things we don't know about each other. And so what the idea of yearning was a way of saying, you know, we can do that if we understand we share some potential to be heard and to express ourselves.
What can you tell us about Jacob and Sarah now in 2014?
You know, one image that comes to mind is when we visited her in her apartment in Ann Arbor. She's working there now. She graduated about a year and a half ago. And he comes in and kind of jumps on her and lays on her. And just, it was really funny because, again, it was this mode of expression that was an embrace, but it was Jacob's embrace. Or he gets right in her face. I think about that experience is that Sarah accepts and welcomes that. I think it was harder to do that when she was in, well, it would be harder for anyone to do that when you're in high school and you're around friends, let's say. I think she always was accepting of that. But that as a sign that she has accommodated his world. And that Jacob will talk more frequently about seeing Sarah and wanting to see Sarah and looking forward to seeing Sarah. So in their own way, they're both finding that connection across that distance.
Bruce Mills, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Bruce Mills is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College, and his memoir is called An Archaeology of Yearning. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.